Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show, a new podcast series from the Investors Chronicle. Each week, our panel of IC staff get together to discuss, well, you guessed it, the latest companies and markets news. This week, I'm joined by Alex Newman, Mark Robinson, and Gemma Slingo. We dive into some of the ramifications of the conflict in Ukraine, as well as looking at the banking sector and a little bit at logistics as well, before Julian Hoffman comes on the pod to discuss his feature, Ready for a Turnaround, The Art of Distinguishing Value Traps from Recovery Gems. Without further ado, let's get going. Hello and welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Rogers. Joining me in the studio, Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. And also Gemma Slingo. Hi, Gemma.
Hi.
Podcast debut. Welcome. And then over the internet, we've got Mark Robinson as well. Hi, Mark.
How's it going, John?
Yeah, good. We replaced you with a different Australian last week, but it's good to have the original back.
Yes.
Well, it's 4 p.m. on Thursday as we record, so things may have moved on a little for your good selves, listener. But of course, we woke up this morning to reports of Russian missile strikes in Ukraine. And our thoughts are with everyone on the ground there and in our Investors Chronicle world as well. The ramifications have been felt pretty much instantly too. Global markets taking a hit across the board as investors shy away from Russian exposure, including a 20% drop in the Moscow Stock Exchange and 40% in the RTS over the course of the day. And meanwhile, oil prices have topped $100 a barrel for the first time since 2014. I wonder if oil is a good place to start our discussion, Alex. Maybe you can chime in on this first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the leap higher for oil prices, which were already just a fraction below $100 before the the full scale ground invasion today. There was a mixture of supply constraint concerns, but also fears about the knock-on effects for the conflagration in Ukraine. I mean, it's very fast moving, as you said. It's unclear what's gonna happen here at the moment. It seems that Russian oil supplies, which could be one of the focuses of sanctions activity, aren't going to be targeted. But I mean, when this podcast goes out, that could be on the table. If that were to happen, then we could certainly see oil reaching, climbing considerably higher, considering that they account for about nearly 5 million barrels of oil exports a day onto the global market. So, no surprise that, in periods of extreme heightened geopolitical volatility that also involve one of the largest oil producers, that we're seeing these kind of moves. And the other knock-on effect is what this might do to supply chains and trade routes, particularly in the Black Sea. So much up in the air right now. So it's no surprise that you're seeing these considerable spikes in commodities. Gold is up a lot higher, albeit for different reasons. Some enormous moves in the markets today. Mark, I mean, you did a piece before it really hit the fan on BP as well. I mean, I suppose UK investors are focused on the oil price, but they're probably more focused on the companies which are most exposed to that. I mean, it's very interesting to see, despite the new leg up for oil prices this morning, that BP was down. I mean, that was something you seemed to anticipate.
It was a speculative piece, of course, but it's not too difficult to imagine that investors would be primarily concerned in the UK over BP because of its 19.7% stake in Rosneft, who's Russia's main oil exporter. We're just second guessing what politicians might do here, but I think there'd be they'd be somewhat reluctant to actually ban oil exports outright into the European Union and world markets itself, because that market is incredibly tight at the moment. Anyway, I've spoken on the podcast before about doubts over Saudi spare capacity, and it's by no means clear whether OPEC could actually release enough production in world markets to keep a lid on prices if, say, for instance, Russia was forced out of the export market temporarily. And, you know, all this comes when inflation is flying ahead and the prospect of oil at $120, $130, $140 a barrel would frighten policymakers as well, because, I mean, that's the main reason behind the general drive of inflation as well. Joe Biden's tried to blame on supply chain disruption, but actually, if you go back to the first days of his administration, he was cancelling all pipelines in the United States, Canada, and that sends out a message, of course, and plus he stopped exploration on federal lands in the US. That sends out a strong message to the industry. And since then, US production has been faltering somewhat. If they were back in the game fully, the situation at the moment wouldn't be quite so acute, I think. I guess politicians, apart from the obvious security angle as well, would also be very wary because of the effect that it would have on credit markets over time. You know, the one place you wouldn't want a credit card at the moment is in Moscow, because the cost of debt there is soared overnight. That's probably predictable in a sense. But if inflation keeps on moving ahead here, then central banks will have to think seriously about multiple rate rises in the year. It's just such a fine balancing act in economies at the moment, because we're a step away from a full-blown recession, I would venture. Mm. And the oil price could actually just trigger that if it keeps on going up at the rate it is at the present time.
I suppose it's, you know, doubtless part of the calculation that Putin has made in you know, timing this invasion now, is that, I mean, gas prices are already very, very high. Europe is very, you know, very nervous about being cut off from those supplies right now. So that kind of, you know, gives Russia a kind of strategic hand in all of this, and then ditto oil.
Oil consumption goes up traditionally during the spring and summer months in the Northern Hemisphere as well. But, you know, conversely, gas imports trail off a little bit, but not enough to make that much of a difference. I mean, it's obviously a very worrying situation, not just from a security perspective, because we're really at the wrong place and time to have this level of disruption. After 2 years or so of pandemic link problems, now we've got this.
Yes, yeah, it's panning out to be a pretty bad decade, isn't it, so far, I'd say. But
it is. But by the same token as well, you know, the old Rothschild's axiom about getting into markets when there's blood on the streets might hold true as well. It sounds rather cynical on the basis, but it is true. I mean, if markets do pull back appreciably as a result of present events as well, it's a time when our readership should be looking at potential bargains in the market.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there is also, you know, considerable volatility at the moment as well, isn't there? And there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of noise, and it's hard to detach any of that from signals. And yeah, I mean, like, I suppose as a magazine, we don't take day trader style outlooks, really. We focus about the, you know, the long term prospects, and they're obviously muddled somewhat when you have such enormous, you know, sort of historical events like this. But there was an interesting quote from Chris Weston, the head of research at Pepperstone, who this week said that you know, trading in headline-driven market is not for everyone. It requires a dedication to being in front of the screens and understanding of what is noise and what is signal, and an ability to keep emotions in check. And I suppose it's, you know, unless you can, you know, you're seeing red across your screens at the moment, and that is sparking fear, and you're trading on fear, then, you know, perhaps the sort of sage advice to kind of stay invested. These kind of moments really, you know,
make that point. You know, study after study has shown that, you know, to keep hold of your holdings, sort of quality holdings over a long period of time is the best way to build your wealth. And certainly, you don't want to be reactive any more than the writers of Investors Chronicle want to be as well. But I suppose in recent times, we've been through the shortest bear market in history. And I imagine that a number of our readers did pretty well out of that. You know, you're always trying to avoid timing markets. That's a bit of a fool's errand. But I do think that it's worth keeping an eye on prospects whenever you get a general sell-off as well. It does present opportunities to get into quality companies at a more viable share price.
Yeah, and I mean, with a few exceptions, I suppose in the UK market, you talked about credit markets in Russia. I mean, mercifully, global equity indices aren't that exposed to the 40% falls, whatever we've seen today in the Russian market. But you know, if you're an investor in Polymetal or Forexpo or BP today, you're obviously, you know, you're weighing your options, and those are very difficult calculations, aren't they, to know what the exposure is to those companies. So we'll be covering it in the weeks ahead, I'm sure, in great depth.
If you're a shareholder in BP, the main thing you'd be worried about at the moment is your dividend coverage as well, because of Rosneft dividends for Rosneft that account for a fair proportion of free cash flow generation for BP. And that's going to have a knock-on effect on dividends if they're out of the game for any length of time. I think we spoke this morning in an editorial meeting as well as have another review of defense stocks, both in Europe and in the US as well. Because if you take a step back, if the problem in Ukraine ends tomorrow, or ends in a week, or ends in a month, you would think that attitudes towards defense spending in Europe as a whole may be permanently altered as a result of this incursion by Russia, which in itself may present opportunities, or at least it makes it worth looking at the sector again. During the Trump administration, he was haranguing other NATO members for not keeping up with their requirement to spend at least 2% of GDP on their armed forces. This time around, it might be a sort of more pressing incentive, as it were. So we'll have a look at that in probably the next issue of the magazine as well.
Just final point on that, you reminded me, a colleague, Arthur Sants, also made an interesting point. We were just talking about this earlier. You know, another potential idea on that theme of, you know, not to highlight companies that benefit from, benefit or profiteer from war. But I mean, one of the potential fallouts from the current situation is, you know, lots of people are speculating about if it widens, that the use of cyber attacks, which is, you know, a new form of warfare that we're all still getting used to and understanding, could escalate. And, you know, there are cybersecurity firms out there which, you know, whose services are possibly going to be in even greater demand following what's happened, you know, the last few days and what may come in the months ahead. So, I mean, lots of food for thought that we'll probably unpack, I imagine.
Yeah, in sort of contrast to the world of cyber, I was having a look at sort of the heavy industry sectors, thinking about how that might be affected by the energy price rises, which obviously have been ongoing for a while. Because I know shortly before Christmas, the chief executive of DS Smith, which is a packaging company, was demanding more support from the government because of these rising energy costs, saying the UK was sort of in a worse position than Europe and the government needed to step in. And obviously, if those costs continue to climb sort of quite sharply, if today's news is anything to go on, I feel sort of the heavy industry might start to suffer even more. And so far, the costs have been passed on to consumers, but presumably at some point, that's going to have to stop. Because I was covering Kingspan as well this week, and their margins had actually started growing. They produce sort of building materials. But I feel if the costs do continue to climb, eventually they're going to start feeling the squeeze.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Like the cost of living squeeze that we're sort of all, you know, before we all started talking about war was the big topic of the last 2 weeks as well. It seems really that companies have been quite adept at managing their margins over the last 6 months and passing that on. But yeah, I mean, can they raise prices again over the next 6 months? It's a really good question. I suppose the outlook for corporate earnings is quite uncertain if they may struggle to do that, and how that might affect demand.
Yeah, well, thanks, guys. Well, as you said a couple of times, we'll keep up the reporting as the drama unfolds, I guess, as we've said by this time tomorrow, what we've said may already start to look slightly irrelevant. But anyway, let's move on to a slightly happier place. I've never described banking as happy before, but by comparison, Mark, you've been responsible for writing up some of the results. Is it HSBC and Barclays you've been on this week?
Yes. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about that as well. Julian Hoffman is covering Lloyds today, and I haven't had a chance to go through the figures. But I guess the most interesting point that came through to me was that I think the banks have been overly pessimistic about the level of credit default coming about as a result of the pandemic, because you're seeing that in the case of HSBC, their profits were boosted by a net release of nearly $1 billion in credit provisions as well. It was much the same with Barclays, but albeit on a different scale as well. And even though with HSB, their statutory profit was just shy of consensus estimates, it's improved markedly because of the recovery and lending opportunities, and also quite a steep rise in fee income as well. The investment arm of the bank has done particularly well over the last 12 months too. Geographically, they did well across the board, but it was their UK banking operation which was probably the standout performer there as well.
Mark, was there much comment on their operating expenses going up, and you know, the bonus season starting to stretch those initial expectations?
Yeah, I think that was more the case with HSBC than Barclays, obviously. I think Barclays had a pool of about £1.7 billion, which is well in excess of what they've had in recent times. But I think they had Barclays had something like a return to shareholders of 15%, a total return to shareholders of 15% through the year as well. So I don't think you're going to worry too much if your traders and investment bankers are starting to coin it in again as well. And as well, the capital ratios were largely unchanged from last time around as well. That might change over the next year with Barclays, just given the returns, the buybacks. They've initiated another buyback, of course. But, you know, they seem in reasonable sort of balance at the moment. I guess we'll invariably get comments in the press about the level of bonuses if that creeps up too much. But what is too much? I mean, if
surely there's only so much the press can cover at any one time.
At the moment, definitely, definitely. I mean, I'm thinking with HSBC, it's interesting at the moment because there's various regional issues that have weighed upon the results, not least of all the Chinese property market as well. Now that has yet to fully play out, but it represents a near to medium term risk factor to the company as well. It just makes me wonder how long it will be. I mean, I've been musing on the fact that you would imagine eventually that they'll switch headquarters over to Hong Kong, but the security situation right there might force something of a rethink on that.
Well, thanks for that, Mark. And you can read those write-ups on our website. And before we go, and while we've got Gemma here, we should get the latest from your beat, which is technically
professional services, but it seems to span a few different firms.
As it tends to here. But you've reported on a takeover bid in the logistics sector.
Yeah, so in the glamorous world of logistics, it emerged on Monday that a company called Clipper is poised to accept a takeover bid from one of its big American rivals called GXO Logistics. So in a nutshell, the deal would value Clipper at about £1 billion, slightly less. But I think sort of beyond the specifics of it, it highlights an interesting trend sort of in the logistics sector. So I think for a long time, logistics and haulage have been seen as pretty low margin and pretty unglamorous. But the tide might start to be turning slightly, particularly since the pandemic, when we've been buying a whole load of stuff online and then usually sending a whole load of it back again, which is sort of engaging with these companies a lot more than we have been in the past. So it seems a lot of the excitement's around e-commerce, and Clipper is a retail logistics company which teams up with companies like John Lewis, JD Sports, those sorts. And analysts seem to be suggesting that's where a lot of the growth opportunities are. So I think basically it will just be interesting to see if this deal has a knock-on effect in the industry and whether companies, I suppose like Wincanton, might be affected by the deal, and whether you'll see more investors being drawn into this space, which had previously been pretty ignored and unloved. So yeah, it'll just be an interesting one to watch, I think.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you, everyone. Unless there's any other business before we go, thank you so much for joining me. We'll catch up with you again next week, and stay with us, listener, because I'll be chatting to Julian Hoffman now about his cover feature, Ready for a Turnaround, The Art of Distinguishing Value Traps from Recovery Gems. And we'll be there right after this. Great. So we've got Julian Hoffman back on the podcast. Your article is on the very front cover of our latest edition of the magazine, Ready for a Turnaround, The Art of Distinguishing Value Traps from Recovery Gems. What got you interested in that, Julian?
Thank you for the introduction, John. Yes, it's my first cover feature since 2014, having returned to the Investors Chronicle. So it's quite an exciting moment. I got interested in this topic. So I had a bit like a sort of dad shouting at the television. At the start of the year, I was looking at a lot of articles. You know, as soon as you put recovery shares into Google or any other search engine, you always get these kind of seven shares for people getting older, seven shares for post-conflict situations, which might be relatively apt, actually, as the current situation. But I looked at these and I thought, actually, there isn't any methodology behind this. There's no one saying, what is the actual art of picking out a recovery share and how does it differ from just saying that the price of something is cheap? Okay, so you've got there is. So when I started researching it, I actually came across a whole literature about academic literature, all coming out of the States, obviously, in the middle part of the 20th century, where people who'd been through the Depression had seen the destruction of a lot of companies, a lot of shareholder value in the 1930s, started to formulate a way of thinking about how to get profit out of situations where companies have got to turn themselves around. So as opposed to saying these shares are going to recover just because they're cheap, the way that I've approached the article is to look at specific corporate situations and how investors can get in those and profit for them. And the key really is to justify what those are. So as you said in your intro, what is the difference between a recovery share and a value trap? Well, I think that there are various interpretations of this, but the easiest way to say it is that a company that is limited in some way by its legal framework, by its ownership structure, by the fact that it can't grow its earnings more than in line with the business or the general market, is a value trap. So there aren't many corporate actions that you can take that would turn that situation around and make it different. Whereas what you need to look for as an investor is actually the opposite. You're looking for companies where there is a possibility that the management's actions will make a substantial difference to their operating performance. And that, I think, is the crucial difference between the two. And I've gone into lots of, I looked up, I started to follow different managers, for example. What have they done over a period of time at different companies? And, what were the actions they took that actually made a difference? And, there were some quite interesting results that came out of that. But, it was a very, it suddenly defined, that there is a lot of investing that isn't about just picking something on the basis that the PE is at a certain level, that there is a, you have to follow a backstory and you have to look at the story behind the story, as it were, in order to get the true sense of recovery share.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that there's actual sort of theses and doctrines behind, finding that recovery share. And you cite one seminal book in the article.
Yes, that's right. The Special Situations in Bonds and Shares, I think it's called. It's from 1955. It's by a guy called Maurice Schiller. He's a very interesting character. He's a near contemporary of Benjamin Graham, who is the kind of the godfather of value investing. But his experience of the 1930s was radically different. So he was looking at, his specialization was companies who were restructuring. So that was where he started. And he worked out that if you looked at certain types of corporate situation, that you could work out what the profit would be on the back of those. So if a company consolidates or it merges, there is a certain amount of cash profit that you can bring out of that, and that will translate into the share price in a certain way as well. So it's a very interesting idea, really, that you buy a share on the basis that you know how much money you're going to make. And it's not a question of, this level, and in 3 or 4 years time they may go up by X amount of percent. You go in thinking I'm going to make 15% on this particular situation, and then his idea is that you then sell out pretty quickly. You're not a particularly long-term holder, but it does depend on the type of situation you're looking at. So if you go into the idea that changing management is always a trigger for a share price recovery, then you could probably stick around for 3 or 4 years. You wouldn't see the profit out of that immediately. So it's all about the market catching up with the situation rather than the situation leading the market. I think that I hope came across quite clearly in the article. And there are just people who are good at restructuring companies. I think there's a guy I talk about called Leo Quinn, in the, who's currently the CEO of Balfour Beatty. And when you look back at his record over quite a few years, over more than 20 years as a senior manager, he's always managed to turn the companies around he's worked in, and the shareholders who stuck with him always made really good profits out of it. And yeah, it's all about a willingness, I think, on the part of the management to take on a business and really have a go at it and radically remodel it. I think that's the only way that these kind of situations work. And your task as an investor is to try and pick those out and to say, well, at the end of the day, how much money am I going to make out of this? And I think the article is really about the methodology that you can use to do that.
Yeah, I mean, a large portion of it, you write your five corporate actions that can trigger recovery. And one of them is the change of management. And you've just mentioned your guy, Leo Quinn, and you write about him. I don't want to give away all five, Julian, because we want to send people to the article itself. But maybe you could give another one. I mean, you've written Spend Your Way to Success, The Case of AstraZeneca. Could you give us the background on that?
Yeah, I mean, Astra, we talked a lot about Astra a couple of weeks back on the podcast, but The reason I picked them out as a special situation is that it was a classic example of a company that needed a new personality to take it in a different direction. But the only way that vision could be fulfilled was by spending every last penny that Astra could afford at that point. So what I thought the way that you could look at that special situation was to make a judgment of the balance sheet and to see how many years into the future they could afford to keep spending at a very high level. And so we sort of ran the numbers on it, and it is basically a decade long story if you want to do something like that. But again, there is a sense of a personality has to come in order to trigger that situation. So they have they bring in this Swiss guy from Roche, who's running a Roche division, and he's got a vision about how to restructure AstraZeneca. Astra had been coasting for years up to that point. They were sitting on 18 billion of cash. They just seemed content to hand out dividends every year that were, you know, kind of coming from a shrinking level of profits. And you know, this Swiss guy comes in, Pascal Soriot, says, okay, this is enough is enough. We have to remodel the company, and we have to have a vision about what he wants to do. So he went into cancer treatments in a very big way, and now Astra arguably is one of the most successful oncology companies, certainly in Europe, and probably comparable with the best of the US ones at the moment, I would say. And the valuation now, from going from, what was it, 8x earnings if you were lucky, is now more than doubled in that time, as has the debt, of obviously. But you know, the difference is that because their products now are so high value, and so I'm bringing in so much cash, that they could afford now, they can afford to service that long-term debt. So there is that sense that come what may, it does take one person to sort things out. And but you do have to pick, you have to match the person to the situation. I think that's the way that I looked at it.
Mm. Well, Julian, thank you so much for that little preview. As I say, you're on the front cover, and the article can be read on page 22 of our magazine, starting on page 22. There's a good, 2,500 words in there, something like that?
Oh, yeah, easily. I think probably even 3,000 by the time I finish with it.
Even 3,000.
Yeah, so if people get through the first 22 pages, it'll be there.
plenty to get your teeth into. Thank you so much, Julian. We'll catch up with you again next week, hopefully. The Companies and Markets podcast was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And if anyone would like to pose a sectoral, company-specific question to our panel, feel free to drop me an email at john.rogers@ft.com. That's john.rogers@ft.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch up with you again next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.